On this episode of The Scorekeepers, join me, your host, Daniel Farrell, as I speak with composer Molly Herron. Molly has had notable works featured at prestigious events like the Bang on a Can Marathon, the Sundance Film Festival, and the Berlin Film Festival. Her body of work includes collaborations with the Argus Quartet, So Percussion, Contemporaneous, and many more. Recently, she premiered her latest orchestral piece, Spin, Span, Spun, with the Orchestra of St. Luke's in New York City. I can't wait to learn about the piece and her creative process. Welcome to The Scorekeepers. Welcome, Molly. Great to have you here.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So in July, you had a piece entitled Spin, Span, Spun. I love that title, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Premiered with the Orchestra of St. Luke's in New York as part of their De Gaetano Composition Institute. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through what the process was like working in that institute and with their resident composer, Anna Klein?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really like nothing that I've had the pleasure of doing before. It was really its own. It's, you know, often there's lots of support in place in different programs to have a orchestra piece played for the first time. But usually, I mean, and when I say lots, I mean incredibly few and far between. But there are those programs out there that exist to have new pieces mounted for orchestra. Right. Largely, they don't also support you composing those pieces. In fact, I believe exclusively they don't support you in composing those pieces except for, you know, degree granting programs. Usually the brand new orchestra work that's being composed in this country by people who don't have a big body of existing work behind them, it's largely done in institutions while people are getting degrees. And of course, there's a lot of gateposts to pass to get to that point, even within the programs often. And this was a program that supported a commission, which was really remarkable. And so just getting the chance to start from the beginning. I have composed orchestra pieces before, but that wasn't actually necessary for applying to this program. Mm. And working with Anna Klein was just amazing. She's wonderful. She's such a thoughtful composer. And I feel like I got so much from her feedback. And yeah, just, writing for orchestra is not just about knowing how to write for orchestra. It's knowing about all the in-crowd stuff that you have to learn about, all the politics of it. Mm. And it was just wonderful to be able to have Anna's feedback through that process. She's, of course, so experienced with orchestra, has interacted on a very intimate level with a lot of orchestras at this point. So she had a really wonderful perspective, and she just was a great sounding board. You know, she just was really open and responsive to ideas and always had good suggestions.
So as part of the program or the commission, you were asked to compose a work based on poetry of a living poet. Mm-hmm. Who did you select and why did you select them?
Yeah, I picked Jean Gallagher. And at first, I love poetry. And so I had a fair number of poets and ideas kind of knocking around in my head, but nothing felt like it was really speaking to me. So I did what any sane person would do in this situation. I just started diving into a lot of poems, and I have a lot of collections of poetry in my home, but I was pretty familiar with them. They weren't going to bring anything new to me. Mm-hmm. And So what I ended up doing was looking at publications that are doing one poem, you know, like Harper's Magazine or the New Yorker, things that have collection, you know, poetry focused magazines and things like that. And I ended up finding a poem by Jean in the New Yorker. And it wasn't the poem that I picked, but I immediately felt a kinship with the way she wrote. Because I have a lot of, I feel very influenced by older music, by Baroque and Renaissance music. And I saw her in this one poem that was called From Noah to Wife Some Years After. She was really playfully engaging with this old, old, old story of Noah, and had this relationship with it that was very, like a very fresh and modern, felt very relevant, felt very engaging to my kind of modern sensibilities, but was interacting with this very old world. And then I got several collections of hers and realized that this was something she does a lot. This is something she really engages with. And it felt like a in parallel to what I was doing to an extent. And that was really what I wanted. I wanted to feel like a relationship with a poet. I didn't want to just say, okay, I'm setting this poem in a, right. You know, in like, not literally, of course, because I didn't have a singer, but like in a narrative way or something like that, or trying to evoke the same kind of vibe that poem evoked. I wanted to feel like I was friends with somebody through their work and doing similar things. And that's why I picked the poem that I did, which was called Spin.
So let's talk about the music. It's a great piece, Spin, Span, Spun. Fantastic performance from the recording.
Yeah, they did a wonderful job.
How did the work first take place? How did you come to write it?
It was something that just kind of, you know, I feel like every piece I write comes about in a slightly different way. This was one that just sort of, I had this idea that I wanted to play with a trill, this little musical ornament that's just going back and forth between two notes that are either a half step or a whole step apart. That's something, it's an ornament that's often used in the Baroque. It's sometimes written in, sometimes not written in. But if it's written in, it's just the, you know, it says TR or something. Right. It's not something that's specifically notated. And it's something just, you know, it feels to me like it enlivens a note or the beginning of a note a little bit. And as I was working more and more with the idea of the trill, I had this sort of mantra running through my head that was my interpretation of what a trill is all about, which is energy through contrast. That trills just kind of, they take these two notes that are pretty dissonant against each other, go back and forth super fast between them, so you almost feel like it's a simultaneity. And then it injects this kind of life force into the material, I think. And so I wanted to use lots of trills in the piece, both in a concrete way and in an abstract way. But I also just wanted to sort of to embody this the mentality of energy through contrast.
And was that your idea, your central idea, through every movement or just singular movement? I mean, I was wondering if you could maybe talk us through what your ideas were for each movement.
Yeah, definitely through every movement. So there's a lot of just straight up trills through the whole piece. The middle movement especially has some more abstract trills.
I love the textures in the second movement.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful. So the second movement has some wider spaces between the notes that are, you're going back and forth with. So there's, instead of that da-na-na-na-na-na kind of trill, there's maybe a da 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 da, kind of going like a kind of a wavering back and forth between notes. And they're also happening at different speeds in the different instruments. So there's sort of some contrast there between the rhythmic landscape of the different layers. There's also there's a kind of a meta trill with that movement where the bass line, the literally what the basses are playing, is going back and forth from A to G to A to G to A to G. And that is underpinned with a series of cadences. So they're cadences that in resolving from the 5 to the 1 or to the 7 to the 1, they are moving back and forth between the chords A and G, and then back up to A and then back down to G. And this, because, you know, when a cadence is when you're arriving at the tonic in a very final seeming way. And usually in common practice Western classical music, that happens either between the 5 chord and the 1 chord or the 7 chord and the 1 chord, because they both have the scale degree 7 that's leading to the right. 1. So that was, you can kind of engineer that in different ways through different inversions of the chord, but I was always looking for that actual whole step connection between the A and the G. And so that's one layer, is this very slow kind of trill that goes on in the bottom layer, going back, wavering back and forth between those pitches. And again, creating that energy through contrast of the dominant and tonic motion. And I should say it's not tonal in the typical way that you would think of as tonal. I use these highly tonal cadential gestures kind of in the context of a more tonal adjacent world where I, as a composer, I tend to have a sense of a pitch center in what I'm writing, but not using all of the, not using the sort of typical constructions of Western classical common practice tonality. And then, so that's the second movement. I also use a lot of percussion instruments that I think are very trilly, like a flexitone, which is this piece of metal that is like it's like a thin piece of metal that has two hard balls on either side of it. And when you wiggle it, it has this kind of, it's kind of like a cartoony sound, but to me, that's just a trill. And there's a few other instruments like that, like a vibraslap or a güiro. A güiro is a wonderful Latin American instrument that has ridges on it, so that it's, again, that contrast of presence of material, absence of material, presence of material. It's like up, down, up, down, up, down. And then you play it with a stick, so you kind of just like go along the grooves. But it's also, for me, just kind of, it's another trill, because you're alternating between the grooves. So little colors like that go through it that for me are trills. And then the movements of the as a whole go, the first movement is the tonal centers also go up, down, up. Of the three altogether. I mean, it's like, it was structurally helpful for me to think about it in all of these levels. I don't care at all if people don't hear that. I don't expect people to hear that. Yeah, it was my way of really embedding that idea in the whole piece.
And did you incorporate any of the ideas from the spin poem itself into the music? Any inspirations from that?
Yeah, absolutely. Jean Gallagher's poem is in three stanzas, which just, you know, it fit really well with what I wanted to do with this piece. I wanted to have, another layer of trill here is that it's fast, slow, fast, which It's not like the way you actually mechanically play a trill that the middle note is slow, but it's that, again, the contrast, the going from one thing to the next and then back to the first thing. And that's also tradition. It's like very referential to the way a piece of Vivaldi would unfold, something that's a Baroque chamber piece, chamber orchestra piece, string orchestra piece, that contrast of the movements. So it was already something that made a lot of sense to me to do, to have three movements. And her poem happens to then be in three stanzas. So and there's a lot of motion in it too. And the motion in her stanzas really feels to me like it connects to what I was doing. And I'll just read a little bit of the poem. So the first stanza begins with, "He gives a push with one foot and sets the room spinning," which felt to me like a really energetic, you know, spinning, moving, you know, she literally uses the word spinning, moving sense. So that to me was connected to what the first movement was. And then the second stanza begins it in the middle of a sentence, but it begins with the word float like empty gold planets over the bed's red continent. And so that is very much the vibe for me of the second movement. It's floating, and it's, you know, the title of the whole piece is Spin, Span, Spun, and the title of the second, and each movement is also subtitled by that one of those words. So the first movement is spin, the second is span, the third is spun. So span is really for me that floating feeling, that there's a lot of suspension and almost an orbiting feeling as the material kind of crashes into these cadences and then comes out again. It's like, you know, floating bounds that crash into cadences and then float out again. And then the third movement, the third stanza begins again in the middle of a sentence, until this hour's gears re-engage and the stories put in motion take on their increasingly plausible, unforeseen freight. That's the entirety of the third stanza. So that, again, for me, felt like a charging forward. And it, on a very basic level, those are the senses of energy and motion I have in my three movements.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, hearing that from you, just wow, like I get so much insight into, you know, what you were thinking with each of those movements. I wanted to talk about how you mentioned earlier about your work being heavily inspired by things like the Baroque period and a mash of these Baroque and older ideas with newer contemporary ideas, kind of like a mix of like Vivaldi and early Haydn, but maybe with like John Adams, you know, thrown in there. It's like, how do you pull all of those influences into your work? Why are you influenced by these older work?
Yeah. Well, I'll start with the why. I mean, if I can't even answer that question, it's kind of a chicken and egg situation. But I started playing an instrument called the viola da gamba when I was a teenager, and that is an instrument that saw its real height of use in the Renaissance and Baroque. And so the music you play on that instrument is Renaissance and Baroque music. And I'll just footnote here, the theorist Dmitri Tomasko has what he calls the peritonal century, which has one foot in the Baroque and one foot in the Renaissance. It's kind of this new categorization of time period that is late late Renaissance, early Baroque. And that's, if everyone was familiar with that that term, that's the term I would use. That's really what I, the music I'm most drawn to. So anyway, when I was a teenager, I started playing a lot of the music from this time period. And so that was either because I already loved Baroque music, or it was how I found it. It's probably a little bit of both. And that just has been, that's been an influence of mine ever since. And of course, then that just, that's a love that keeps giving and keeps going deeper as you listen more and learn more. It's really just a matter for me of following my nose and following the things I love. And then when my ear's really engaged by something, I just ask why. Why do I love this thing? Why am I so engaged by it? And how can I use it? How can I steal it? How can I make it my own? And that's just been a lifelong journey. The thing that I feel such a connection with Jean Gallagher, the poet, about is that we're both people who are fully speaking in our modern voice. You know, I'm never trying to copy anything that sound, I'm not trying to write neo-Baroque music. I'm not trying to write something that sounds Baroque. I am pulling from the ideas of that time, and I'm in conversation with it. The music that I put down on the page is really, it's my interaction with that older material. It's not me trying to, let's listen to it through my ears, kind of thing. And I'm trying to convey to the listener what I feel in my engagement with that music. So it's partly, it's just a sort of, I like to write music that I want to listen to, and that's, there's something about that that's really just kind of instinctual, you know, it's just what happens naturally. But I have spent a lot of time thinking about this stuff, and a really big part of me working through a lot of these ideas was an album that I put out in 2021 called Through Lines. That is, it's all music for three or four violas da gamba. And that was a lot of working through that question of how do all these influences mix together? What does the actual musical material sound like that is influenced by these ideas of the Baroque and Renaissance, but come through me? And that was, you know, the answer is a multiplicity of things and better musically answered, I think, than than with words.
In general, what does your compositional process look like? What are the first steps you take when you're approaching a new piece?
I just panic for a good couple weeks.
Don't we all?
Yeah, it can look different from different pieces. The bulk of what it is me sitting in front of a notation program. That's largely how I work. And I do a lot of listening back. I'm very engaged with the sonic feedback I get from my program. And I do a lot of what I studied with Michael Gordon, the composer, obviously the composer. I studied with Michael Gordon, and he used to call it improvising into your notation, where you're just kind of messing with stuff. So I do a lot of active messing with stuff and just trying things out different ways in the actual notation. So that's like really the bulk of it. But leading into that, I do often improvise some bits of material that come into that. That can be at the viola da gamba. It can be at the piano, just like finding little bits of material. I have a notebook that I sketch things out in. I also write a lot, just like writing English words, trying to get stuff out of my head, just having a conversation with myself about clarifying what I want. Pieces for me usually start with, I'm like going backwards because I wasn't sure how to answer this question. And now I'm like, oh, unraveling. Yes, actually, the earlier things I tend to do, I tend to start with kind of defining for myself what the vibe is going to be, what the sort of the feel of the timbral space, the combination of sort of timbral space and energy, how that's going to combine to create a feel. Like I like my music to feel like you're in a space, that you've entered a world, and that I kind of hold you in that world for the duration of the piece. So that requires me to kind of define for myself, ooh, I want this to be like a cold and suspended place, or I want this to be a warm and rolling place, or, you know, whatever that is. Kind of defining for myself what techniques are going to get me there. I usually don't start with actual melodic, rhythmic, chordal material. I usually start with like, what's that world I want to build? And then I slowly will put together the pieces of what that world is in terms of rhythm, in terms of melody, in terms of harmony.
I love that conceptual. Like you said, vibe. Vibe is such a good word for it. The textual vibe that you're going for.
I love the word vibe. What did we ever do before California saved us and came up with vibe?
You're also an assistant professor of composition and theory at Vanderbilt University.
I am, yes.
And I was wondering how if you do incorporate new music and your work as a composer into the teaching method with your students?
Well, I teach composition, so it's pretty ever-present. I love teaching because it allows a space where I can be constantly in conversation with other composers in a meaningful way. There's lots of ways that people can create that context for themselves, as you have yourself, Daniel, with this show. But yeah, it's a lovely way to engage with other composers. And the thing that's so fabulous about being an artist and being someone who teaches artists is that, yes, there's always things to learn. There's a point to being a student as an artist, but it's completely different from being an engineer who's a student, or being a veterinarian who's a student. There's always stuff that you can grow from the associations you have with other people, but it's not the kind of thing where you learn how to do it over the course of time.
No.
People can come in with really well fleshed out artistic identities, and then it's just about playing and developing. So it's not this kind of like hierarchical structure of I've got all the knowledge and I'm passing it on to you. We get to just share and grow together, which I love about being an artist teacher. I've always felt like that. I used to teach, and I hope I do again someday. I used to teach kids a lot, like 8, 9-year-olds, composition. And it's the same deal. They're complete artists. They're complete beings who are bringing something to the table. I'm bringing what I've got. They're bringing what they've got. And it's really a conversation of equals. I mean that completely seriously. I may know more technical things, but when it comes to the the artistry, the engagement of artistry and creativity, we're right together on the same plane.
So what do you have on the horizon? Any new works you're working on?
I'm actually working on another orchestra piece right now. And that's it's a piece I'm writing for the sesquicentennial for Vanderbilt University. Wow. Vanderbilt is turning 150. And so that's what I'm kind of really elbows deep in the mix with right now. And then next, I'm going to be working on a piece for a really wonderful chamber duo called 48 St. Stephen's that is violin and piano, Clara Kim on violin, Angela Kim, no relationship to each other, on piano. And my idea for the piece is to be engaging with some of the scorditura of the wonderful Baroque composer H.I.F. von Bieber, the other Bieber, as he is sometimes known. He was one of the most, possibly like the best composer who a lot of people have never heard of. I think he's a totally, totally inspiring figure. I encourage everyone to go out and check out his music. Really wild, kooky dude. And, but also elegant and, you know, all the things I love in an artist. He was also possibly the best violinist of his day. And so his technical virtuosity as a performer figures a lot into his writing. And he wrote a few pieces. Probably the most known is what's called the Mystery Sonatas or the Rosary Sonatas, which is a series of sonatas, most of which he uses scorditura for. Scorditura meaning the retuning of the violin to the non-standard. So the standard tuning of the violin is the G below middle C and then up in fifths, G, D, A, E. But you can, of course, tune those strings to different pitches, and he did that frequently. And so I'm looking forward to really getting into his work, engaging with his work, and thinking about how these different string tunings affect the material that gets then written on the instrument.
Wow, that sounds really cool. Well, thank you, Molly. You can, of course, you know, go check out her work on her site and across, you know, you have a few albums out on various streaming services, which we'll have links to. But it's been wonderful speaking to you and learning about your process and about this piece as well.
Yeah, it's wonderful to talk to you too, Daniel. Thank you so much for your insightful questions.
I loved hearing about the super interesting creative thoughts behind Spin Span Spun. Be sure to check out Molly's site to hear more of her work. Thanks for listening to The Scorekeepers. The Scorekeepers is produced by Daniel Farrell Music and Sound, with graphic and visual design by Patrick Farrell. Scorekeepers is proudly hosted and recorded using Zencastr. Make sure you subscribe to hear new episodes of The Scorekeepers wherever you listen. And be sure to rate and review this episode to help us find new listeners. Thanks for listening.